You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
This podcast is being brought to you by Voyage AC. And honey, I think we're done, right?
Done?
Holiday shopping.
I can tell
when we can't see the floor in your office anymore because it's literally covered.
With all these gorgeous, elegant Voyage AC gift bags and boxes, right? Voyage AC has incredible presents for every age and gender, beautiful scents, incredible candles and scents for the home, luxurious bubble bath, and glorious face and body products. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find Voyage AC at our brand new website at theonlyonepod.com, or you can go to www.voyageac.com directly. That's VOYAGEETCIE.com.
And even during the holidays, Melanie is still willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now. That is 10% off everything you buy.
All you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is the ultimate luxury blend of travel, design, and sense.
This podcast is supported by Cute Booty Lounge. And by the way, hon, your booty is looking well. It's looking really good in those leggings today.
Thanks, hon. Yeah, I love them. These leggings are super sexy, but they're also so incredibly comfortable. Sometimes I forget what I'm wearing. And for those of you who don't know, our season 11 sponsor, Cute Booty Lounge, or CBL's Kelly Nishimoto, is about to launch her own podcast called Behind the Booty. And we love Kelly and CBL so much that we've been bringing you some of the first episodes of Behind the Booty exclusively right here on The Only One in the Room. So look for it on Thursdays over the next few weeks.
Cute Booty Lounge is made right here in the USA by women and for women. The company is incredible, female and minority owned.
And everything they make makes your booty look amazing. Their leggings, right, have these super cute patented scrunch butt pockets. And they have a fit for everyone. I mean everyone. So you can order a pair for anyone on your holiday list.
And don't think you missed out on Black Friday prices. If you head to cutebooty.com right now and enter the code THEONLYBOOTY, you'll get 15% off your first order. Mm. And like Laura said, they have a style and size for everyone.
Right? So get your holiday shopping done and buy her a gift that she will literally live in.
My thoughts exactly. So head to cutebooty.com and enter the code THEONLYBOOTY to get 15% off your first order. And don't forget to tune in on Thursdays to a new episode of Behind the Booty with Kelly Nishimoto. Embrace your body. Love your booty.
Hi, I'm Angela Rose, and I'm the only one who was kidnapped at knife point. I felt that feeling that I should run or get away, and that I looked behind me, and this man was following me. And I put my key into the lock of my car, and all of a sudden, you know, I was grabbed from behind. And what was so haunting is that his car was parked right by my car. He threw me into the car and bound my hands behind my back, and he taped my eyes shut, but he didn't know that I could see. But I could see just down to the left and down to the right, and I made a very conscious decision in that car. I said, if I get out of this alive, he is not going to get away with it.
Picture this. You're 17 and walking to your car after work. and a man follows you, puts a knife to your throat, and puts you in his car. Angela Rose, victim empowerment advocate and founder of PAVE, which stands for Promoting Awareness Victim Empowerment, kept her cool and remembered everything that happened to her the day she was abducted and sexually assaulted. But what would you do if the first set of officers assigned to your case failed to make you and your parents feel safe? Would you give up on the process and let your assailant walk free? Or would you persevere, ensure that he was sent to prison, and start an organization to empower victims from all walks of life? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. Hi, Angela Rose. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Really excited about this interview. I don't know if excited is the right word. I've been looking forward to it because this is something that I think it's really important to talk about and get out there. And you are the perfect person to do this with. And we had such a great talk on the phone. So we're going to continue that for our listeners. But before we start, I wanted to ask you, because it is the holiday season, and holidays can be tough for survivors of any kind. Do you have any hacks or anything, any advice for people who are going through the holidays as a survivor?
I'm a huge advocate for self-care. And one thing that's so important is to realize that we can't control what other people say. The only thing that we can control is ourselves. And so I'm a firm believer in the serenity prayer and really understanding the difference between what we can and cannot control. And so, you know, just having some grace, and even for our family members, sometimes well-meaning loved ones actually might have had an experience of some type of trauma in their past. And so for them to either say victim blaming things or possibly not believe us can also be a defense mechanism for them. So I think also holding that grace and space for understanding why some people aren't as supportive as they need to be.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And I love that you're employing the serenity prayer there. Scott and I are both in recovery. That's actually where we met 13 years ago.
Beautiful.
And that's part of our daily mantras. And, you know, we go to that. It is associated with recovery, but it's not a recovery thing. It was something that was around long before it. And it works. It works just like you said. So thank you for that. So I am Laura Cathcart Robbins. This is The Only One in the Room, but I'm never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, honey. Yeah, Angela just discovered that we were honeys to each other.
Uh-huh. I love her expression when she saw that. She was like, oh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. She's like, oh, I see what's going on. She knows because she met her husband through work, and we'll talk about that a little bit at the end, but I'm going to introduce her to you. Angela Rose. In 2001, Angela founded the nonprofit organization Promoting Awareness Victim Empowerment, or PAVE, to create education and action surrounding the issues of sexual violence. Today, PAVE has chapters in multiple states, trains fraternities and sororities on sexual assault. So needed. Thank you for doing that. And convened the National Campus Sexual Assault Summit held at Georgetown Law that broadcast it live to over 300 colleges. Wow. Angela's work on college campuses led to an invitation to the White House for the launch of the It's On Us campaign, and was asked to serve on the White House task force to protect students from sexual assault, which was chaired by then Vice President Biden. So, wow, wow. There's so much more to your bio, but I'm going to interview you and we're going to talk about a lot of the things that are in there. And welcome and thank you for your service.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a blessing.
So we're going to kind of get right into the story that we're going to tell. Statistically speaking, when someone gets into a perpetrator's car, they don't make it out. So take me through what happened to you that day that you were kidnapped and assaulted in that Chicago suburb?
Well, it was broad daylight. And that's, to me, one of the most haunting parts about it. I think that a lot of times young women, when we would leave work at night, you know, working at the shopping mall, we would be, you know, very careful. We'd walk out together, possibly have mall security walk us out. But it was a sunny summer evening. And I didn't know this at the time, but this man had been watching me and possibly stalking me. But I didn't know that. And I think when you're 17, there's such an I am invincible attitude. You know, you just don't think that things like that can happen. And I love music. And I was carrying a CD in my hand, walking towards my car. And you know that spidey sense where you feel like something's wrong? I felt that feeling that I should run or get away. And then I looked behind me and this man was following me. And the employees had to park in a different lot that's a little bit farther away from the mall, but it was still in an outside area. And so I saw him approaching me and I actually blushed. I had turned bright red because I had been singing out loud. I was, you know, embarrassed that he had heard me singing. And I put my key into the lock of my car and all of a sudden, you know, I was grabbed from behind. And what was so haunting is that this parking lot is huge. This mall is huge. And his car was parked right by my car. So that's another haunting memory that like he had been watching me. And so anyway, he threw me into the car and bound my hands behind my back and he taped my eyes shut, but he didn't know that I could see, but I could see just down to the left and down to the right. And I made a very conscious decision in that car. I said, if I get out of this alive, he is not going to get away with it. So faith is a huge part of my life. And, you know, I just really, at that moment, I look back and I feel like that was truly my spiritual awakening. You know, I felt somehow like there was this divine presence around me. And I look back now and wonder if, you know, maybe it was the girl that he had killed. Her name was Julie Angel. And, you know, so anyway, I went down after he let me go. I kept trying to personalize myself in the car. He asked me what my name was. I made up a name and I kept saying to him, you need to let me go. My parents are looking for me. I'm not going to say anything. Just, you know, you need to let me go. And I was sexually assaulted, but he wound up dropping me back off, not to the same place that he picked me up from. But when I went down to report what happened to me that night at the police station, I was very surprised at how poorly I was treated by the responding officer. And that to me is something that has really fueled my passion, is education for first responders, especially law enforcement, on how to react. Even like nonverbal body cues is so important. You know, he had his hands folded like this and just had such this air of, you know, just callousness. And he didn't believe me. He didn't believe me at all. He accused me of lying.
I want to talk about that in depth, actually, because I think that's such an important part of your story. You were 17 when this happened. What was your home like at that point?
So I have two younger sisters that I'm very close with. So they're, you know, 3 years younger, 6 years younger. And so we were all very close growing up. We're an Italian family. So we, you know, always had a lot of fun together. And my mom was actually at a family party in the city when this happened. And I'm very close to my grandma. She was just my best friend. And so this was before cell phones. I know it's hard for us to remember a time before cell phones, but there was such a time. And so when, you know, I actually had to call, you know, my parents from where he dropped me off from. And it was just such a haunting experience to, you know, just, it feels like an out-of-body experience. And I can tell you from a lot of other survivors of trauma, oftentimes because of the way that we're wired, our minds try and protect ourselves. And so oftentimes there's like this notion of dissociation where physically you're here, but mentally and emotionally you're somewhere else. It's almost like you're looking down on yourself. And I experienced that quite a bit during the assault.
I'm just trying to get a picture here. You have parents that are still together at that point, right?
At that point, actually, they wound up getting divorced after, but that, you know, that's a whole other story. It does cause a lot of trauma on the family and going through these kinds of things. But but they were together. My dad was at home babysitting my sisters.
Yeah. You're 17. Sounds like you were pretty happy if you were singing out loud on the way to your car.
Oh, I was so excited. I was going to a graduation party. I was homecoming queen that senior year of high school. I just felt like my whole life was ahead of me. It was, you know, you feel like you're on cloud nine, you know?
And so your spidey sense is tingling, which I love. I think women have a very heightened intuition that society tells us to ignore over and over and over again.
Absolutely, yes.
This man was able to grab you and get you into his car in the back seat or the front seat?
The back seat at first, and then he made me come up to the front seat afterwards.
Okay. And then how long did you drive after that? Do you remember?
It was probably 40, 45 minutes. And it's such an eerie feeling because I'm seeing people next to me, right, in the cars, because we're on the expressway at this point. And like, do I mouth for help? You know, it's just such a strange experience. And especially at 17 to look your life and kind of flash before you and say, is this really the last day for me? And I think that's why today, every single day, I really wake up and thank God for another day, because tomorrow's not promised to anyone.
And I'm just thinking while you're talking about that young woman, I think she was 16, who was just rescued from a car in Kentucky. She's from North Carolina. And she used that hand signal, right? Right. For DV violence.
Yes. Exactly. And that was a TikTok viral sensation, which was amazing.
You know, way back, obviously, this is before social media, before cell phones. But do you mouth for help? Do you do this? So now we have that as a tool for people. Yes. Now people know about it. More people know about it. And so he takes you about 45 minutes out. That's where the assault occurs. This is where I was really struck by your story. And I know you and I talked about this a lot. Why did he take you home or take you, drop you off somewhere after that, instead of either leaving you there or going further and hurting you or murdering you?
I had that same question. I think there was a little bit of survivor's guilt that I had. So I actually wrote him a letter in prison when he was convicted, because I wanted to know that question. Why me? Why do we all look similar? A lot of his victims, we look very similar. Our facial features, like, was it somebody that he knew in his past? You know, I just had so many unanswered questions. So two things. One is that I think it's important for survivors to understand that we're going to have a lot of questions, oftentimes that we're not going to ever know the answer to. And I think that's part of the healing journey, is to be okay with that, because oftentimes we're not going to know the answers to these questions. But also, the police did say that me trying to personalize myself in the car was something that helped to potentially save my life. That I was not an object, that I was trying to humanize myself. Now, that wasn't conscious for me. I didn't plan on doing that, you know, but that's one thing that the police did say possibly saved my life, but it's hard to say.
So on the 48 hours that I watched, where they talked about your case and other cases too, I believe they played a tape of an officer interviewing you right afterward. Maybe it was the 911 call, and the call is chilling because you sound so composed for a 17-year-old. But you're describing what happened to you.
Hello.
Hello, ma'am.
Yes.
Can you tell me what your name is?
Angela.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me what happened?
I was going out to my car. I work at Jordan Marie in Woodfield.
Okay.
And I was parked outside, and it was about 6 o'clock, and I'd gotten off of work.
Okay. Just real brief, were you forced into your own vehicle or someone else's?
No, his.
Okay. Can you tell me anything about the car? Did you get the license plate or the color?
The license plate, it was looked like it was a Trans Am. It was looked like it was brown. He had a Bensonville sticker on the right side, like a Village sticker.
Okay.
All I can tell you, he blindfolded me. I don't know, the antenna. All I can tell you is the antenna was, like, broken off and taped up again.
Can you tell me what he looks like? Was he a white male, a black male?
He was white. He was between late 30s or early 40s.
Okay, what color hair does he have?
Brown.
Did he rape you at all, ma'am?
No, but very close.
Okay. Did he sexually assault you in any way?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, can you tell me anything about anything at all, the car he was driving, anything that officers might be able to look for, which way he went?
No, he dropped me off in a parking garage, and he kept the blindfold on me and made me wait in the stairwell, and then he untied me and he drove away.
One of the officers said in all of his years of doing this job that Angela was by far the best witness he'd ever dealt with. That's a quote. How did you know to pay attention the way that you did, and how did you keep yourself from dissociating at that moment, or just succumbing to like a fear brownout?
Well, all I can say is it's a God thing. I mean, there's really nothing else for me to say, except now after 25 years, I've been doing a lot of research into what happens in the mind of survivors. And when we go through trauma, oftentimes we don't remember details chronologically, certainly. And that's what makes it so difficult oftentimes to try and prosecute these cases, because oftentimes survivors just don't, because of a lot of neurobiological issues that are happening in the brain at the time of trauma. So, you know, for me, I really do feel like it was a God thing. I have no other reason, you know, there's really no explanation for that, except I can remember very vividly, as I mentioned earlier, I did make a conscious decision in the car. I said, I will remember everything. It was a very intentional decision to try and remember everything that I could in case I was able to get out of that situation alive.
Yeah. Wow. His name is Robert Coppa. Coppa? Coppa?
People have pronounced it different ways. I'm not sure.
You alluded to Julie Angel. He kidnapped her and murdered her before he kidnapped you.
Yes.
And you talked about that just a little bit ago, being the beginning of your spiritual awakening, when you realized that you had a purpose in this, right?
Yes.
Tell me about the bond you felt with her.
I was able to meet her family, the mother and the sister of Julie, very soon after I was kidnapped. So thankfully, they put two new detectives on the case, and that's how they were able to bring him to justice. These two detectives were amazing. They did everything they could to really walk me through the process of, you know, remembering these details, because again, nothing was done on my case that night. But as I started to learn about Julie from her family, she loved music the way that I loved music. She was very outgoing, had a lot of friends, you know, loved to dance to music in the basement in their jukebox that they had in the basement. So I felt, and I still feel so connected to her. I mean, I don't really get emotional when I talk about my story, but to think that, like, I have two amazing kids and an amazing life and an amazing husband, and I've been able to experience so many things that she, you know, never was able to. And so that to me is like a driving force of what I do, because if we can help protect other people and help save other people's lives, like that's what this is all about, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Thank you for that. I know that is emotional. And when you told me, I was actually driving when you and I talked, and that was like a time where I was like at a stoplight, and I just needed a minute after we talked about that, because we don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, but you said that you felt like she was with you.
I did, and I still do.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, I can tell you that when he pulled over into this forest preserve, which was where I was sexually assaulted, I felt like maybe I should run or get away, but there was this sort of inner knowing, or I don't want to say a voice, but you know, if anybody has experienced faith, it's almost like you hear these things without it being audible. And it was just this sort of inner knowing that I should stay in the car. And what I found out later was that Julie was murdered when she ran away. And so I just wonder, is there, you know, people think that's crazy, I'm sure. But, you know, for me, just thinking about her as this kind of angel in my life, we created a scholarship around her name, and so I just want to do everything I can to try and keep her memory alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. I don't think that's crazy at all.
Thank you.
I think to get out of there, to stay, would have been entirely counterintuitive.
Yes.
So for you to have done that and survived against all odds, I have no doubt that there was something else at work there. You know,
I really do agree. And, you know, the haunting part about the car, you know, beyond, you know, the sexual assault part, was he makes all of his victims change clothes. And so that's another reason why I knew that he had been following me, because he had this dress that fit me like a glove. So he asked me what my dress size was. And I mean, this is like out of a psychological thriller. Like sometimes I talk about this and I can't even believe that this, you know, happened to me. But he, you know, I heard him rustling in the back. And so he made me wear this evening gown. And when he zipped it up, it fit like a glove. And so when they caught him, they went into this, he created this secret closet in his house, because he was married, by the way, the perpetrator.
He
met a woman
that.
In a prison pen pal program when he was in. She was from Japan, much younger. She was in her 20s when he was in his 50s. But he said that he was in for armed robbery and failed to mention rape and kidnap and murder and all these things. But he basically created this hidden closet. And when they, you know, they caught him, he had the exact same dress in all these dress sizes. So again, it was so haunting. Like, how did you know what dress size I was? Why were you watching me? Did you know where I lived? You know, all these things. Yeah. So,
wow. Well, and you said that there was a similarity between you and the other victims as well. So I'm sure there was some tie. Did he respond to your letter, the one that you wrote him?
No. And he's still alive. He thankfully was able to be behind bars to protect other people, because the very first time that I came forward on the news about my story, it was just the back of my head. I wasn't ready to show my face yet, because I'm sure a lot of listeners have experienced shame if you go through trauma, especially sexual trauma. There's a lot of perceived shame around these things. And so I just wasn't ready to show my face yet. And so I made a plea for other young women to come forward. I said, I know that I am not the only girl that he's done this to. He was on parole for, what was it, maybe 6 to 8 months when he kidnapped me, and four other girls came forward.
Wow.
Very similar stories. Wow. And so I was able to meet a couple of them, which was amazing. So, you know, the community support, you know, here we are around Thanksgiving time. And for me, like just being so grateful for my community, for the people that supported me, my grandmother, you know, and we started this petition drive very soon after this happened to me. We had like 5,000-6,000 signatures on these petitions to try and toughen up, you know, tougher laws for repeat sex offenders. And we did that work with Julie's family. And so just that type of support was just unparalleled and helped me so much in my healing journey to kind of take my anger and put it into activism, to feel like I was trying to create something that was going to help other people. We were able to enact the Sexually Violent Persons Commitment Act in Illinois. And that was, you know, you just feel like all that pain that you went through, you can at least try and funnel that pain into something positive.
We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. So wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
I know that you were 17, which is almost 18, which is, you know, but 17 is still a kid. And to become an activist and to take that energy and that experience and use it to help other people is something that not a lot of adults ever do. And I really admire your passion for it.
I appreciate that. I really thank my grandma for that, by the way. She called me a couple of days after I was kidnapped and she said, "Angela, I know this was hard for you, but this happened to you for a reason and you have to do everything you can to keep him in prison." And just her saying that, it almost like instantaneously, I felt like I went from victim to survivor. It's like, you know, you're victimized by something, but you survive it and you've got a purpose. Yeah. And now I feel like I'm a thriver. You know, you thrive after these negative experiences.
Yeah, well, you are. You don't just feel like it. You definitely are. And you're inspiring as well. You picked him up out of a lineup. I saw that lineup. What was really weird was I knew exactly who he was before you said he was number three. He just looked like the guy. He looked like, you know, the guy you described as well, but so did the other ones, you know. And I wanted to know how it was. I know you were safe behind glass. I know he couldn't see you. But how was that to see him again?
Well, it was difficult. And it was about less than a week after I was kidnapped. I actually had my college placement exams. And I was at the college that I was supposed to go to in the middle of this huge room of students. And somebody came to the front of the room and said, "Angela, you need to grab your things. There's basically a family emergency." And it turned out they had someone in custody. So we had to drive 3 hours back. And it, you know, that I had to pick him out of the lineup. It was such a strange experience. And when I saw him, of course, it sends that chill up your spine. But what was even more haunting for me was his voice. Mm. I remember hearing him in court because, of course, it took so long to go through trial. It took 4 years for my case to come to trial. And between that, there were so many motions. And so you'd have, you know, you see him in court. So seeing him was difficult, certainly. But hearing his voice for some reason was just a lot more haunting.
Yeah, I can completely understand that. But I'm thinking you didn't actually see that much during it, but you were hearing him the
whole
time. Good
point. I never thought about that, Laura. That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah, boy. The list of charges against him, like you alluded to earlier, they're so ugly and so terrifying. Kidnapping, armed violence, and sexual assault. Lifelong history of violence. And his public defenders knew they'd have a very difficult time trying to seat a jury that would have any sympathy for him, right? So they decided to gamble and request a bench trial, which means that a judge decides, right?
Correct.
You testified at that trial.
A quick mention on the charges. What took so long for my case to come to trial was the knife that he kidnapped me with had to be a certain length of the blade, which it was, for it to be a class X felony, which is the worst felony, which basically enabled him to get a life in prison sentence. But the serrated part, you know, of the blade was 3.75 inches. So the judge threw that out of court because of the serrated part. And I'm thinking to myself, if he stabs me, like, it's going in 4 inches. You know, I mean, yeah. To me, it was just so crazy that we have to go through all these motions and jump through these hoops. And so that charge was unanimously reinstated by a higher court, but it just took so long to come to trial. And so my family was amazing. My grandparents and all their senior friends, we call them the senior brigade, were in the front row of every hearing, and having other survivors, other of his past survivors, even from the 80s, came to try and make sure that they could do everything they could to put this man away. And so when I testified, I had gone away to college in Madison, Wisconsin. I actually had founded PAVE at that point. So it was years after I was, so that was 4 years later. I must have been 20, 21 years old. But it was very, very difficult. I had an amazing attorney, the district attorney. But I remember just like having my hands just kind of clenched together. And the strange part about if anyone listening has never been a victim of a crime, what is important to note is that it's a crime against the state, not a crime against you, which means I'm a witness in my own trial. So I couldn't even be there for the trial. I was not allowed to, you know, listen to what they were talking about in terms of the insanity defense. So being a witness, I could only be in court when I gave my testimony.
Wow.
There is a part of me that felt so empowered by looking at him and saying, like, this is what he did to me. And so, you know, a little while later, a month or so after, when they were going to sentence him, I wrote a victim impact statement of how this crime had impacted my life. And the defense cross-examined me, which is something they have never seen before. They put me under oath. And this is, again, after the trial is over. The victim impact statement is something that's supposed to empower survivors, let them know how this crime is impacted so they can tell the court. And they swear me in, and I read my statement, and the defense attorney starts cross-examining me in like this very intense way. Like, well, is it true that you have no longstanding physical ramifications? But a lot of times our pain and the things that we deal with, the emotional scars, aren't physically visible. I had a lot of post-traumatic stress. I would walk with my hand over my throat when I'd walk to class. You know, I had to do a lot of EMDR therapy, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, to help with the PTSD. And so I just think that there's so much work that we need to do in the way that survivors are treated. And I don't want to really, you know, with my story, I don't want to discourage anyone from reporting. We know that sexual assault is the most underreported crime. We're really trying to get the report rates up. But we also need to remember that that choice should really be the survivors, because when we've been through trauma, all of our choices have been taken. So I'm a big advocate for letting survivors have options and choices so they can navigate their own journey.
Thank you. Thank you for all of that. He's in prison for the rest of his life. He was convicted over and over and over again on different charges. Is that right?
Yes. So in the state of Illinois, it's three class X felonies and it's mandatory life in prison.
Okay.
And he was sentenced to 30 years. So in a 4 month span in 1980, he kidnapped a woman. He raped a woman, putting groceries in her car, and killed Julie Angel. Those are the ones that we know about. That's within a very short period of time in 1980. He was on parole for other crimes in the 70s when he did these crimes in 1980. He was sentenced to 30 years and got out in 12 for good behavior. Now, that's since changed in terms of the good behavior, but there's so much work that needs to be done. I know we've come a long way because of Me Too and Time's Up. We've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, we do, which brings me to the thing that I wanted to, that you alluded to also at kind of at the top of the interview. And again, not to discourage anybody from reporting, because we can't change anything if it's not put front and center and people are made to face consequences of their actions. But you weren't treated well by the responding officers. Is that correct?
Correct. Even my parents weren't. I mean, they wouldn't let my mom and dad see me. I'm still underage. And so my mom is like pacing back and forth and they threatened to kick her out of the police station. I mean, it was wild. It made me feel like I was a criminal, you know?
Right, right. So tell me about creating PAVE, promoting awareness, victim empowerment.
I looked for a group like PAVE to join when I went away to college, and I went to Madison, Wisconsin, which has a long history of activism, and I looked for a group like PAVE to join, and there wasn't one. But I didn't want to reinvent the wheel or step on anybody's toes, so I was very intentional about interviewing a lot of people to find out what's missing. What's the missing piece? And what we found out what was missing was prevention education, but done in a positive way. I think that people would rather be pro something instead of against something. So PAVE is pro-consent, pro-healthy relationships, pro-bystander intervention, pro-supporting survivors. So that was missing, was like engaging men and women to be a part of the solution. And then also what was missing was a holistic healing, really looking at that mind, body, soul approach, trauma, sensitive yoga, movement therapy. You know, there's just so many different things. And so we partnered with the local rape crisis center, partnered with politicians. So we just did a lot of partnership work. We did a lot of work on campus with the LGBT center, with the multicultural student center. I think it's really important for us as a movement and as an organization, certainly, to look at this holistically, that there's a lot of additional mm-hmm. barriers that certain groups go through, even for reporting, barriers to talking to their families about these things. So I'm very passionate about that. So our first kickoff meeting was February of 2001 in Madison, and I was hoping for like 10 to 11 people, and 75 people came. And so we had like great music playing, upbeat music. And so we realized like we're onto something here. Pretty soon after, other colleges wanted to start a PAVE chapter. And so we created a manual of how to start a chapter. And so now here we are, you know, 20 years later, and we have a couple of really exciting initiatives. One is we have developed a very comprehensive tool for survivors of domestic violence, human trafficking, and sexual violence that's launching in December. We have a beta version, but it's survivors.org. And we're launching with a billboard in Times Square, which we're very excited about because I want people walking to look up and say, okay, I'm not alone, because so many people feel very isolated and alone. And we're still continuing our college work. But one thing I learned in working with the White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Violence is the best way to prevent these things on college campuses, in the military — we do a lot of work in the military — but to start the conversation younger. We need to start talking to our kids about consent and healthy relationships in an age-appropriate way. And there's a way to do that in an age-appropriate way. So that's been really exciting. We also have a support dog program. So going back to what I dealt with in the police station, our newest program that I'm so excited about — we had some great coverage on NBC Nightly News recently — we have the support dog program, where most of the time support dogs are trained just to be with one handler. But we've partnered with an internationally known dog trainer who has trained these dogs to live in the police station, to not only help with law enforcement, because obviously you want a responding detective who's going to be as calm and as mentally focused and, you know, as well as they can be, but also for survivors when they report. And there is nothing like that out there. So we're able to allow this dog to help when survivors go to report. And so Denver adopted one of our dogs. I was able to fly down also with the dog handler to U.S. Capitol Police with everything that they dealt with the insurrection. And they requested a second dog. So our first Black lab made such an impact that they requested a second dog. So that's been very exciting.
I love that. And I love that idea. We have Black Labradoodles, two girls.
Oh, nice.
They're so sweet, but they are so empathetic.
Yes.
And so sweet. If someone is distressed, they're right next to them.
That's right.
You know, it's so helpful. It's like you just absentmindedly get to pet this dog who's just there to love you.
That's right. And it really does calm the parasympathetic nervous system, brings the heart rate down. And
absolutely. You and I talked about Gabby Petito's case, which was tragic. She was a young, white, attractive young woman, blonde woman. Her case got more media coverage than any case that I've seen in a very long time. Wall to wall, 24 hours a day, looking for her, mourning her, looking for him. We talked about the juxtaposition of the coverage of her case to women of color in this country.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I can even talk about my own personal experience, because there was a young African-American girl from Chicago that was kidnapped right around the same time that I was. And my case garnered a lot of media attention. And I remember being even 17 or 18, looking at this with the lens of making sure that we really try and uplift the voices of everyone, not just blonde white women. And I think as a movement, I do feel like we are going in a direction of making sure that we uplift all voices, particularly voices of color. So we had a great BIPOC panel and AAPI panel during Sexual Assault Awareness Month, like really making sure that we give a platform and a voice specifically to survivors of color. And one thing that we keep hearing is like, you know, from survivors of color, them saying it's even more difficult to even talk about in our family. If the perpetrator is within our community, you know, oftentimes they're not going to want to report, or they're being told not to report because you don't want shame on the community. And so I just think as a society and as a movement, we need to be very mindful of the way that we look at this. And even the way journalists talk about these issues in general, I think oftentimes it's the perpetrator. They don't focus on the perpetrator. It's like they focus on the victim, and they mm-hmm. use very sexualized language. Like if you even look at childhood sexual abuse, they'll use the word panties for a five-year-old. I'm like, I'm sorry, a five-year-old wears underpants. She doesn't wear mm-hmm. panties. Thank you very much. Right. And so we actually did it years ago in DC at the National Press Club, the DC National Press Club. We held a training event for journalists to really be educated on how to talk about these issues in a way that's appropriate and is respectful to survivors of all colors and all gender identities, because there's so many male survivors as well.
Yeah. Thank you for talking about that. And thank you for continuing to talk about it. And it's because of allies like you that the other voices get raised. We're not able to do it on our own. And I really appreciate you continuing just to hit this point. I mean, I've seen you do it. I've seen your interviews. You always make sure to go back and create that equity, right? Because it's not created for us. We have to do it. And we need allies like you in order to do so. So tell me two things. If I'm a victim of a sexual assault, how do I find PAVE and how do I get involved? And if I'm someone who wants to be involved on the other end to contribute, whatever that looks like, tell me both those things.
Certainly. So our website is shatteringthesilence.org. We also, for the survivor side, have survivors.org. We have partnered with 1,300 local agencies across the country that we verified to be a part of our network. So it's a searchable functionality. In the next couple of weeks, you're going to see a new interface, as I mentioned, around International Human Rights Day. We're going to have the official launch of survivors.org. But for us, I have found so much healing in using my voice and helping other people. And everybody's healing journey is unique. So we do have a lot of resources on our website. Like we have a great trauma sensitive yoga series, because you really feel sometimes when you go through trauma out of touch with your body. So like getting had that body autonomy back is really crucial. And breath work, you know, just finding ways to calm. So we also partnered with Andrea Constant, who was the survivor in the Bill Cosby case, and her book just came out. We were a big part of her book, which I was so humbled and surprised about, frankly. But she did a beautiful healing bowl meditation with these crystal bowls, like using sound therapy, which can be very, very healing. So I think what's important for survivors to realize is everybody's healing journey is unique. And oftentimes it can feel like maybe a couple steps forward and one step back, but don't be discouraged. Healing isn't always linear. There's so many different healing modalities. And if one doesn't work for you, there's so many others. So we've got a lot of those on our website. And if anybody wants to contribute, especially for end of year giving, we would really appreciate it. We have actually a lot of high schools that want our program that we don't have the budget or the capacity. So there is definitely a need there. And so, yeah, we would appreciate hearing from you. We also have a great newsletter, and you can find us also on social media at PaveInfo. And our website, again, is shatteringthesilence.org.
Beautiful. I just thought of somebody I want to connect you with. She's a friend of mine named Holly Whitaker. She wrote this book called Quit Like a Woman. Ooh, and it's about women and alcohol and the effect that big alcohol has had on women, specifically with regard to sexual assault, et cetera, that without alcohol, most college sexual assaults would not exist.
That's right. I would love to connect with her. And just a real quick point on that. When I was in Madison, one of the laws that we tried so hard to change, eventually we were successful. But in the Wisconsin state statute, which is, you know, Wisconsin's a big drinking culture, it said if a person is rendered incapacitated by an intoxicant, then it's second degree sexual assault. And in the statute, it said alcohol is not an intoxicant. It's like, but if you look at boating, driving, like alcohol is certainly an intoxicant. So it took us
The intoxicant.
Yeah. It took us 2.5 years to get that changed. But it was a labor of love.
That is astounding.
It is. It is.
Well, thank you for doing that, too.
Well, thank you. And also the notion of consent, I think, it legal. Like, there is no state that has truly codified the definition of consent. So that's another thing I'm very passionate about as well.
Again, just for myself as a woman of color, as a survivor myself, I thank you for your work. Scott and I, between us, have 3 kids on college campuses right now. You know, my 2 boys and his 2 girls. have a lot of support from us, from their families. And I talk to my boys about consent very early on. You know, Scott is very much into empowering his daughters, making them aware, making them just to let them know what's actually going on in the world, as opposed to that cloak of invincibility that you talked about, because none of us are. And then my thing with his daughters is to listen to their intuition. You know, yes. When they feel it, it doesn't matter if you look crazy. It doesn't matter if you're impolite.
That's right.
If you feel that urge to get out or to get to safety or whatever that looks like, just do it.
Yes.
Your story is evidence of that. So thank you for it. And tell me where people can find you on social media.
Sure. So on Twitter, I'm Tweet Angela Rose, and that's probably the best way to find me. But I'm so grateful for your time and for sharing also that you're a survivor. Thank you for sharing, because anytime I feel like we share, it gives people the strength and the power that they can share their own experience. So thank you for that.
It does indeed. Thank you. Thank you so much, Angela.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Angela.
I appreciate you.
Thank you so much for listening. The Only One in the Room is produced by the creative genius that is Scott Slaughter and edited by the uber-talented polymath Christina Barcy and her team at Avon House Productions. Hey, you're still listening? Good. Please subscribe right now while you're thinking about it, quick, before you forget. And be sure to like and leave us a review of the show. Want to connect with some other Only One listeners? Be sure to join our private Only One in the Room Facebook group or check out Patreon on our website for exclusive content that you won't find anywhere else. And do you have an Only One in the Room story that you'd like to share? Please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. So, hey, we've been making this podcast for over 2.5 years.
What?
Yep. Thanks to listeners like you. And from the gate, people have asked us for merchandise or additional content or even some hang time with me and Scott.
That's weird.
It is. But we think we have a solution for you.
Yep. We are excited to announce that we have a new Patreon page.
Yeah. And you know how people are patrons of the arts? Well, in this case, we're the arts.
Hmm. And by becoming a Patreon, you'll get bonus content, access to outtakes that the general public will never see, extremely cool merch, and depending on what tier you get on, a monthly hang time with Laura and I.
Yep, and it all starts at just $5 a month.
That's nothing.
Right? Not per day, not per week. It's only $5 per month.
And you're guaranteed merchandise.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So click the link in the show notes to read about the different tiers and see what great stuff you can get. Become a podcast patron. Join our Patreon today at www.patreon.com/theonlyoneintheroom.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.